Now I am open for questions. Yeah, there's one question that was written. Here's the first one, and then we're going to bring the mic around. This first one was written out in a recent article that Scott Ritter wrote called The Five Iraqs. He expressed a hope at the end of the article that maybe one way through an outcome is that the Mahdi army and the Sunni militias might form a nationalist alliance versus the pro-Iranian Badr brigades that are currently the government of Iran. Do you still think this is a possibility?
I would say that when we speak of the future of Iraq, I'm one of these people that's disdainful of the history of the Western civilization, where you have white men sitting in the back room smoking cigars, drawing lines on a map for other people. We got Africa that way, we got the Middle East that way, and we have nothing but problems since then. I think it's up to the people of Iraq to determine their future. I mean, we haven't given them much hope, and we certainly, we screwed. A lot of people say, you know, there's the pottery barn rule at play here. You broke it, you own it. We never owned it to begin with. We did a darn good job of breaking it. But, you know, at some point in time, you know, I could understand if somebody comes in the pottery barn and actually bumps one vase and it falls down. You guys have seen Borat, though, right? Where he goes into the and he's just tearing the whole shop apart. At some point in time, it's better to get the person out of the shop. And that's what it is in Iraq today. We're breaking it. We're breaking it even more every day. Let's just get us out of Iraq and stop breaking it and let the Iraqis pick it up and fix it. Now, people will say, well, that's going to mean civil war. The Iraqis can't get along. And what I postulated in this article is that, you know, the concept of the eternal Sunni-Shia split is false. There are people who are trying to exacerbate Sunni-Shia differences. But we saw in 2004 the Muqtadir al-Sadr, and I'm not here to sing his praises. I don't agree with hardly anything the guy stands for, but he's an Iraqi. So it doesn't matter if I agree with him or not. It's his damn country. And he says that our Shia are going to work with these Sunni to oppose this fake purple finger government. And I say, well, wait a minute. That's Shia and Sunni working together. And some of the Sunni awakening are working with Shia. And I say, wait a minute. That's Sunni and Shia working together. There's a dynamic here that maybe doesn't bring about doom and gloom of perpetual civil war. Iraq is broken. It's going to be bloody. There is no elegant solution. If we withdraw, it's going to be ugly. But you know what? A couple things. Americans won't be dying. Americans won't be killing Iraqis. And now the Iraqis will be liberated to resolve their differences themselves. Isn't that what it's all about?
I want to know how you feel about Keith Olbermann.
I've written an article on my website called Jeff Cohen. The website's jeffcohen.org. The article was, is Keith Olbermann on thin ice? Keith Olbermann came into MSNBC as we were being terminated. You didn't hear anything from Keith Olbermann that was any different than anyone else during that first period of time when Bush was still popular and the war was popular. Olbermann has been very good at calibrating his dissent. As Bush and the war have declined in popularity, he's gotten more and more vocal. I commend him for it. His guest list, frankly, sucks. You know, if you think you need more of the wisdom of that guy Howard Fineman or Dana Milbank, I mean, what really rankled the management when we were there is we were trying to get people like Scott Ritter on the air, Phyllis Bennis, advocates for the American Islamic community, Palestinian rights. We didn't have these Newsweek and Washington Post people on day after day. I'm glad he's there. I know people that work on his show. Trust me, the people who fired us still run the network. Same management, same owner. Who's the owner? General Electric. GE is the owner. So, if there were another terrorist incident here and he was still speaking out for civil liberties, I'd give him about a week. The problem in our media is the corporate ownership. That's why I support groups like Free Press and this big coalition. I mean, you have Free Press, the local group, and Free Press, the national. But we need to break up the media monopolies. And there's a website called StopBigMedia.com if you want to become a part of that coalition. Until we change the ownership of the media, we won't have an unfurling of Democratic discourse in the mainstream. We are getting it in the independent. I should mention the publication Free Press and the website, which is local. I was told there's also an independent newspaper called Liberty Voice. Give the radio station again. WCRS is on FM, and 1580 must be Liberal Talk Radio AM. Okay, and if you don't know about those places, go to them, spread the word about them.
Yeah, thank you for coming, but I got to say I'm somewhat critical. I've been active in the peace and labor movement as a steelworker for over 40 years. And one of the problems I really have at this point is right now the American people are the most active they're ever going to be. The labor movement, unlike Vietnam, is totally opposed to this war. We have this huge mobilization going on, and we have these kind of meetings where we complain about the corporate media, and I agree with everything that's said about that, but we don't have any program coming out of here to unite with the rest of the American people and develop some sort of electoral program. And I think we've isolated ourselves and continue to do that. And that's frustrating and self-defeating. And I think we need to solve that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll give my short response. And then, of course, Scott has written a book about how the peace movement can broaden out, and he can give his response. My political response to that is I believe we need one major political party in this country that stands up for workers, the environment, consumer rights, and for peace and diplomacy. And the only way we're going to get to that one major party, I believe, is if people work and take one over. The right wing, for religious fundamentalism and corporate greed, they worked for 35 years, non-glamorous work, going to Republican county committees, Republican town committees, took over state Republican parties. And before you know it, a group really of extremists had taken over a political party. And it culminated in the election, perhaps the stolen one a couple times, of George W. Bush. So my argument is I believe that we need to take over the Democratic Party and turn it into a party that actually stands for something. Now, so in terms of how these various social movements can begin to get more power, I think we got to take over the Democratic Party county by county, state by state, until we have better candidates than Hillary Clinton. And I think, you know, and that means that if you have these people that you elect that are Democrats and you worked hard to make sure a Republican didn't win, and then those people sell you out because they keep funding the war, they vote for NAFTA or CAFTA, you know, on issue after issue, civil liberties, they sell you out, then it's your responsibility to take those people on in primaries. And if you take one day, if we do this kind of work, and it's not fun, it's not glamorous, it's attending small meetings, then bigger meetings, I think over a period of 20 years, we could have one political party in this country that actually stands up for the American public. And I think then we'd be in a totally different situation. That's why I work with progressive Democrats of America.
You know, you're absolutely right. I mean, the concerns you expressed are my concerns. I mean, today's a wonderful day. Thank you very much for coming out. I applaud it. But if all that happens is that we came here, we had a little feel-good session, and then we go home and there's no follow-through, what a total waste of time. We might as well have just gone, lit candles, held hands, and sang kumbaya, because it'll be the same effect. Ladies and gentlemen, we're at war. We're at war, and this is the thing I try to impress on the anti-war movement. Whether you like it or not, you're in a life and death struggle for your future and the future of your country. Until you recognize that and start organizing in a manner which reflects the seriousness of the situation, you're going to get your butt kicked over and over and over again. You're not winning right now. You're losing. And with all due respect, all these workers that are anti, where the hell are they? They're out there in individual clusters. But there's no umbrella effort to bring them together to make a politically viable movement. And this is why I wrote a book called The Art of War for the Anti-War Movement. It's not an A to Z blueprint that's going to tell you exactly, but it gives you some principles. First of all, it's the principle of recognizing you are at war. Prepare yourselves for such. You're going to have to wage war, not stick a bayonet in somebody's gut and twist it. Ideological warfare. This is about America winning votes. We have a constitution that sets forth a process that everybody's frustrated with because it requires the American people to actually mobilize. Well, mobilize. The Union sets a good example. At the end of the book, I talk about, Sun Tzu, Clausewitz, Napoleon, a wonderful Air Force guy named Boyd, who taught me something called the OODA loop. I'm not going to bore you with it, but it's the secret to winning every fight you get into, ladies and gentlemen, if you are prepared for war. If you're prepared for feeling good, holding hands, little mutual gratification. I mean, come on. That's not what war is about. War's wading into the enemy and cutting them down. War is destroying the enemy. War is ensuring that you win. War is not for losers, except for the other guys. But we're the losers now. It's late in the fourth quarter and the score's 60-0, and we're still cheering? No. Saul Alinsky, great union organizer, set the principles upon which maybe the anti-war movement, the peace movement, the progressive movement can look to create this kind of organization. But it can't be flatline organization. I get in a lot of trouble with people like Tom Hayden and others because, you know, one of the problems with this feel-good movement that we're in is we all want to feel good. We all want to be part of it. So when we say, who has an idea? Well, we all have an idea. And we all raise our hands, and then we get nothing done because everybody's idea has to count the same. No. Identify a core value, ladies and gentlemen. The gentleman said, we didn't give you something. I gave you the biggest gift I could offer. Was a recommendation that you define your core value as the Constitution of the United States of America, make everything derived thereof. Because now you don't have an anti-war movement, you don't have a progressive, you have an American movement. And you can get all Americans to rally behind that cause if you organize appropriately. Flatline isn't going to hack it. You know what a flatline is to a firefighter like me? A dead body. When I go to a car accident, I put my little EKG monitors on the bodies, and they flatline. They're dead. You know what I want to see? Triangular blips. Blip, blip. Why? That means there's a heartbeat. You need to organize as such. Somebody's got to be in charge. Somebody's got to call the shots. There's got to be leaders, and there's got to be followers, and it works if they all agree on the same message. Get your act together. Get your act together, and then we can truly win and do the things that Jeff says to get a party that represents progressive values, American values and ideals. But it isn't going to happen on its own. It isn't going to happen with us just coming to meetings and going home. We're going to have to get our minds hardened to ideological conflict and then prepared to wage peace with all of the intensity and ferocity that we ask our soldiers to wage war. That's it.
I want to add just a quick postscript. The independent media is the way that we're getting the word out, and we're actually reaching new people. I don't believe this stuff that Amy Goodman's only talking to the already convinced. If it's the already convinced, it keeps growing because of her efforts. How many people get your news on the web from commondreams.org, which I consider the single best source if you only have 20 minutes? How many of you have ever given any money to commondreams.org? The key thing is that if we can build the independent media and you can tell people, hey, you may not agree with me, but listen to WCRS at what time is Amy on? Listen to them 3 o'clock. I know you're a Republican or you're pro-war. Just listen to her for 3 days in a row. I mean, using the media to reach new people is key. And we can only have these independent media grow if we support them. And she's on Direct Satellite and Dish Network Satellite. Okay, let's go to someone else.
You may have already said it, but I need you to say it again. What do you think is the most single compelling argument that I can say to family members and friends who, when I say Iran is not a threat, despite everything you are hearing to the contrary, and despite the fact that you don't have time to read 5 newspapers like my husband does, what do you find to be the most single compelling thing that I can say to them? Because otherwise they write me off as a crazy lefty that is getting as much biased information from my sources as they are from the other sources.
The problem is if you're dealing with a closed mind, you're dealing with a closed mind, and there's nothing you can say to open their mind. If you got their attention for just a second, say two things. Say, one, the CIA acknowledges that there is no ongoing active nuclear weapons program. Two, the FBI has just debunked a case that had been put out there that Iran supported a bombing in Argentina that's used by the Bush administration. And the bottom line is to say this. Look, if the CIA and the FBI are questioning this, don't you think you have a duty and responsibility to question it as well? I'm not asking you to come over to the dark side. I'm just asking you to maybe don't rush off to war yet. Maybe we should take a little bit of time, because there's a reason to doubt that Iran is an ongoing active threat. The CIA doubts it. The FBI doubts it. So why not call a pause and just say, you know, we don't have to go and give the Iranians a loving embrace, although if they traveled to Iran, that would change their entire perspective of that nation. But if they want to remain ignorant here in Columbus, Ohio, and just wrap themselves around their daily existence, as all Americans do, 300 million people, technologically advanced, the most ignorant people on the face of the earth about the world we live in, that's the lifestyle they want, so be it. But respect the sacrifice of the service members whose lives are going to be put at risk by going against Iran, by at least saying that before we go to war, we exhaust every venue possible short of war, and we have to give diplomacy a chance because there is reason to doubt.
I would also bring up the history, which is not debatable, the recent history that when 9/11 happened, one of the first countries to denounce it was Iran. And then they proceeded to help the U.S. fight their enemy, the Taliban, and overthrow them. And during that time, and there's articles in Esquire, you find this in mainstream sources, in 2001, Iran was really moving toward talking more and more, and it was the Bush administration that shunned them. How? Because just when the Iranian leadership thought they were really making headway with the U.S. and moving toward a rapprochement, what happened? They watched a speech called the State of the Union speech, where out of the blue, even though they've been working with us, he denounces them as part of the so-called axis of evil. In 2003, this is in Esquire magazine, you can find it anywhere on the web, a fax came to the U.S. from the Iranians. It seemed to be with the assent of the supreme leader of Iran, and it is a theocracy. Ahmadinejad is not in power. It's a theocracy. Ayatollah Khamenei is. It seemed to be from the leadership of the country, and it said, we want to negotiate everything. Everything's on the table, including what seemed to be possible recognition of Israel down the road. The Iranians have been trying to talk to us for the last few years. It's our side that wants war. There's that article in Esquire about the two whistleblowers whose names are the man and the woman who were negotiating. One CIA, one was the National Security Agency. When this overture came from the leadership of Iran, this fax, this is amazing. And they go to Condoleezza Rice, they went to Hadley, and they got shot down saying, we will not negotiate with Iran. You have to communicate to the American people that the Iranians have been extending their hand, the leadership, meaning the theocrats. Ahmadinejad, pardon my Yiddish, he's a mashugana. But he doesn't have his finger, as Scott always says, on the buttons of power. The power is in the hands of the Ayatollah, and they've been looking for a way to talk to the U.S. for years now, and everyone who studies it knows it.
Yes, I'd like to comment, Jeff, we talked just before, about media reform. You know, independent press is very, very important, and we need to have net neutrality. We need to keep doing all the things that we're doing, and that is work within the Democratic Party. And change the Democratic Party, take over the Democratic Party, if you will. But what do we do when we get there? We have to have media reform, and we have to have a restoration of the fairness doctrine.
Yeah, I'll just do it real fast so we can get back to Iraq and Iran. At the end of my book, I have a media reform plan, the various planks. The group, the national group, Free Press, has a series of reforms. Clearly, what we need to do is go back to the 777 rule or something like it. A few years ago, there was a rule that said one individual, one company in the whole country could only own 7 TV stations, 7 AM radio, and 7 FM. That rule was obliterated under Reagan and further obliterated under Bill Clinton in 1996. He was getting the big donations from the media companies, and he and Gingrich shoved through a telecommunications bill that gave more power to the media titans so they could become even more titanic. We need to break them up. We need to have something new in our country. We've never really had it, which is fully funded and insulated public broadcasting. Other countries know what that is. In our country, we have National Pentagon Radio, NPR. At least at the national level, the news you get from Washington, from NPR and PBS, is no different than commercial news. It's corporate news. We need public broadcasting. I'll just leave you with one reform. It's in my book. It's from McChesney, the professor. Wouldn't it be great if you could take $150 of your income tax every year and direct it to the nonprofit media outlet of your choice? You want to fund a community radio station, you get a tax. There's $150 you save from going to the Pentagon budget, and you sent it to his budget at WCRS. And if you're pro-gun, you can get it to an NRA newsletter. You're pro-life, you send it to a pro-life. It's completely content neutral, therefore it passes constitutional muster, and it could get hundreds of millions of dollars into the nonprofit sector where you could have real production values, well-paid journalists, and you start competing with NBC and CBS. And so there's all sorts of reforms, but what's stopping us from having this media reform agenda? It's that when the Democrats have control of Congress, it's the corporate Democrats that go to the leadership. If you had progressive party taking power with a progressive White House, we could reform the media in a matter of 4, 5, 6 years. It would be a completely small D Democratic media.
I want to thank you guys for coming to the home of the stolen elections. Very brave of you to set foot here. We have – the clock is ticking on the Bush administration. How do we – can you give us two or three specific steps that we can do to prevent these guys from going into Iran and for getting us out of Iraq, by the time this hell of the Bush administration is over?
It's very difficult when we're dealing with an administration that creates its own reality. And I say that not tongue-in-cheek. This is actually the case. The Bush administration doesn't deal with real facts. They deal with their facts. And these are facts that they believe they have the ability to create by combining the overwhelming strengths of American military, economic, and political power. Because we don't live in a similar fantasy world, our solutions don't fit the real problem. And the real problem is the Bush administration and the fact that they are going to be in office for the rest of their term. There's really no hope of terminating this administration. The best we can hope for is to cause an awakening of our own here at home. I will say this. I in my analysis, again, it's analysis based upon a knowledge of what it takes to take this nation to war. A window of strike opportunity opens in late March, April, for the Bush administration to act militarily in a significant way on Iran. It closes around June. And there's really nothing we can do to stop the Bush administration if they want to pull the trigger during this period of time. It's a foregone conclusion. Congress has already removed all constitutional roadblocks. The military budget has already been set. The munitions have been purchased, and the facilities are being upgraded and modified as we speak. The forces are being surged into place. So it's really, if the Bush administration wants to pull the trigger in March, April, it's done. We can't stop it. And that's just the reality. However, if we are fortunate enough that for whatever reason this elective war is put on hold by the Bush administration because their sense of reality hasn't the planets haven't aligned themselves, we do believe, I believe, have a grace period in the summer. And what we need to do is get Iran injected into this national election dialogue. I don't know how we do that. People such as Jeff and yourself, people who are experts on the media, we need to get it injected, not just in independent media, but we need to have a guerrilla warfare plan here to get it injected into mainstream media. It must be available to all Americans everywhere. Now, this might require the indirect approach. What I mean by that is, if we write op-ed pieces to the newspaper, they might reject them as just the impressions of, some wacko lefty. Go out there and start recruiting experts to write these op-eds for you and get these op-eds placed in newspapers and get these voices who haven't been tainted by mainstream media on the on television. I mean, there has to be a concerted effort here, a campaign, to identify experts and give them the support they need to get their voice, which isn't their voice, it's our voice, heard. But we have to inject Iran into the national debate this summer. That is the only chance we have of shutting down the fall window of opportunity that's going to open sometime in October. And that is the best way to stop this war. I will also tell you that those Americans who buy into sanctions as a viable option to war, it's garbage. Sanctions are nothing but a facilitator of war. We learned that with Iraq. And so I'll give you a little one-sentence mantra. Stop the sanctions, you stop the war. That's the bottom line. The sanctions basically create the conditions for military action. If you stop the sanctions, you've undermined these conditions. But we live in dangerous times, and we've been so lackadaisical as a collective, and I don't mean necessarily the people in this room. I'm talking about the people in this nation, that there's nothing we can do to stop this war if the Bush administration wants to pull the trigger in April. If we can inject it into the dialogue this summer and make it part of the national debate and discussion, there's the potential that real reality will trump Bush's fake reality and will make this elective war of destruction an impossibility for him to go forth on.
A couple quick things. I think that how many people know what Congressman Wexler is trying to do?
Yeah.
Congressman Wexler is trying to have hearings in the Judiciary Committee that would investigate our unitary executive that might lead to impeachment. I believe it's good to put these people on the defensive. And I think we're very close to getting some sort of hearings out of the Judiciary Committee. They may not be the hearings we want, but if you've got any grassroots mobilizing capability, I would rally people to support the Wexler initiative to have hearings because they could begin within a week or two. They've got to be put on the defensive. Nancy Pelosi's strategy has been a complete and total failure. Saying that impeachment is off the table from the beginning was just stupid. Almost everything they've done has been stupid. And I should point out that the problem isn't Nancy Pelosi so much. There's two people that are gunning for her job that are even worse than her. And their names are Steny Hoyer and Rahm Emanuel. I work closely with the people who will never say die in Congress, the people like Barbara Lee, Lynn Woolsey, Maxine Waters. You're never going to stop these people pushing to cut off funds to Iraq and trying to prevent the expansion of the war into Iran. I think to put them on the defensive through new hearings is key. And then in terms of a media angle, how many people here are members of MoveOn.org? They've done some polling of their members and found that one of the main thing the members wanted was activism to prevent an attack on Iran. And I'm a loyal member of MoveOn. I've obviously been critical of the leadership sometimes, but I'm proud to be a member. I think it's up to you to say to them that we don't want to waste huge amounts of money on Hillary Clinton unless she takes a certain position on Iran, different than what she's been saying. But in the meantime, you want your donations to move on, to go to these TV commercials that could be in that window of opportunity that Scott's talking about, where Move On can easily raise tens of millions of dollars, and certainly for an Iran commercial, a few million dollars, to make sure it's in key places throughout the country. Talk to Move On and say you want them to focus on preventing an attack on Iran, even if that means they can't lavish money on candidates that don't deserve it in the first place.
Okay, this question is for Mr. Ritter. I have one for Mr. Ritter and Mr. Cohen. Mr. Ritter, if you could tell, I heard you on C-SPAN, and as a matter of fact, you kept me up that night, when you said what was going to happen if we attack Iran, if you could say that. And Mr. Cohen, I think since our media is so vile in its misinformation, I think the way to hurt them is through the pocketbook. I mean, we ought to consider canceling our cable subscriptions. Or, I mean, if that's too radical, perhaps we need to block those news stations and notify MSNBC, CNN, that we will block them from our cable service until they, you know. So what do you think?
Well, I may have already given people indigestion today, so I don't know if I want to disturb their sleep patterns. But first of all, I'll say this. You know, my name is not Nostradamus. I don't have a crystal ball, and whenever one's thrust in front of me, I try and gaze into it, and all I see is the my eyeballs staring back. You just basically have to judge things based upon patterns of behavior and analysis based on the facts. One thing they taught me in the Marine Corps, they taught me a number of things, many good life lessons, many things I lose sleep over at night. First of all, no plan survives initial contact with the enemy. So we can have all these Pentagon planners out there plotting this wonderful little short 7-day war, and the moment the first bomb is dropped, a dynamic will occur that makes that plan moot. The other thing I was taught is the enemy has a vote. You know, that you don't just get to sit there and dictate and dictate and dictate. Believe it or not, once you engage in war, the enemy gets to do whatever the enemy wants to do. Usually involves trying to kill you. And they do have a vote. And the Iranians will vote, and they will vote often. They studied the Chicago system of democracy. Vote early, vote often. And if we have the audacity to attack Iran in violation of international law without justification, the Iranians have every right to defend themselves with all the ferocity that that nation will be able to bring to bear. Now, they're not going to be able to stand toe-to-toe with the United States military. They have a good military. It's not a bad military, but we got the best military in the world. We better for $796 billion a year. And, you know, toe-to-toe, we can do some things. So they'll hit us in other ways. For instance, one of the first things that will probably happen if we attack Iran is that they will launch missiles against Israel. And this will change the entire dynamic of that conflict. Because while the president has made a concerted effort to recruit Arab nations to oppose an Iranian-dominated Shia crescent, once Israel gets into the conflict, if Israel retaliates, I don't see co-religionists fighting co-religionists over Israel. Okay, so that changes the dynamic as well. The other thing is, I don't think the Iranians are going to sit there and let the United States feed its economy off of Middle East oil. They have the ability to shut down the Strait of Hormuz. They have the ability to interdict oil production in Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, and the eastern Saudi oil fields. If they choose to do this, our economy is a mess already, and it's just going to get worse. There's the real chance of an immediate economic backlash. But, you know, we talk about a 7-day bombing campaign. That would be against the nuclear infrastructure, Iranian Revolutionary Guard Command, etc. That won't work. I've only been to Iran once, but what I saw of Iran was enough to let me know that that nation's just not going to roll over and play dead when we bomb them. They fought an 8-year war against Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and they suffered hundreds of thousands of casualties. These guys know what it means to go to war. They don't love war. They don't want war. But if we want to bring it on, they'll give it to us, and they'll feed it to us in big chunks. So they won't roll over and play dead. Then we have to go to that 30-day bombing campaign. But now 30 days plays into their advantage, because in that 30-day period, believe me, the Iranians have studied what war is in that region. They know that region better than we do. Therefore, they will exploit this intimacy to ensure that they get in some good blows, especially to the soft underbelly of the American war machine, which isn't the divisions on the front line, but the American economy. And when they shut down the American economy, America will scream. It will scream bloody murder. Not because of high casualties, but because of high costs. And so now the president's going to be under pressure, because now we got 30 days to win the war, and we're not going to win it in 30 days. So at the end of that 30-day period, we got to do the unthinkable, the thing that nobody wants to do. We got to put troops on the ground. So the first thing we'll do is we'll put about 30,000 Marines over the Straits of Hormuz to occupy Bandar Abbas and Chabahar, seek to secure the straits. Not enough to push in inland, and you can't push inland. Anybody who's studied geography of Iran knows there's a big mountain range right there. Marines aren't going very far. They'll take Bandar Abbas, they'll take Chabahar, but it won't be pretty. And then we're going to have to go in and threaten Tehran itself. So we'll put about 80,000 troops in Azerbaijan, and we'll punch down the Caspian Sea coast. Oh, we got the troops. We got the troops. If you don't think we have the troops, go back and count all over again. Do basic math. One-third deployed, one-third coming back, one-third ready to go. Freeze the deployed, push the third forward. I doubled the number of combat troops available right now. I can't sustain it, and that's the problem. Because now I've initiated an expansion of the war that is unsustainable. Unsustainable at a time when our economy is faltering, when the popularity of the conflict is going down. Remember, this is an elective war, not a necessary war. This isn't Pearl Harbor. We started this. And the American public is going to flee from this war like you wouldn't believe. Now the pressure is going to be on the president who started this war to win. And how do you define victory? getting the Iranians to admit defeat. But the Iranians aren't going to admit defeat now. You started us, you brought it on, they're going to fight you. And they're going to fight hard. Just think about the IDF going up against Hezbollah the summer of 2006. Everybody thought the IDF would roll over these poor little ragheads. But Hezbollah taught them a lesson or two. Taught them what deep tunneling is. They taught them what fighting is on home turf. Hezbollah fought them to a standstill. Hezbollah were the students. The Iranians were the teachers. And if we go to war against Iran, we're going to war against the masters. And so we put our troops on their soil, and they're going to kick our butt. Not in terms of destroying divisions, but in terms of not being defeated. And now we run out of troops. Now we got a problem. We've committed everything. We have no reserves. Our air campaign hasn't worked. We have no ability to conventionally defeat these people, and our economy is screaming to a halt. And here comes the nightmare situation, ladies and gentlemen, because what option is left? No, the draft's going to take 180, 360 days to implement. Nuke them. You see, the Bush administration has done an amazing thing in the last 7 years. They've taken nuclear weapons off the table in terms of mutually assured destruction. They've created a new category of nuclear weapons called usable nukes. Now, I'm a simple Marine. I don't have the best grasp of the English language. But when someone says, I got a usable nuke, that means they might want to use it. And so you have to study the conditions under which they might want to use it. And you have to understand the Bush administration has changed the nuclear implementation so that we can now use nuclear weapons preemptively in a non-nuclear environment. So that's the nightmare scenario, ladies and gentlemen. Who's the lady that asked about what do you tell your friends? Tell them this. Pick an American city. Pick two. Because I tell you, we drop a nuclear weapon on Iran, the genie is out of the bottle. And the Islamic fundamentalists will not rest until they exact a nuclear retribution on American soil. We will lose a city, and that's a guarantee. Pick one. San Francisco? Pick one. New York? Pick one. Cleveland? I don't know about Cleveland. It's already been nuked. But the point is, I'm sorry. My point is, this is starting a game where there is only the potential of bad things to happen. Nothing good will come from a conflict with Iran. Only bad things can come. And therefore, why start this mess? Iran poses a threat to no one, especially the United States of America.
I just want to... Yeah. A quick answer on the media aspect. How many people have been to our website of FAIR, the Media Watch Group, FAIR.org? You know, it's always a two-pronged approach. You use your powers and your activism to build up independent media while you're dialoguing, organizing against the big media to fight for more openings. And I think you're right. When you turn off an outlet or you depart from an outlet, you write them a letter and you tell them this is the reason why, because you had so many war voices for peace voices. And until you change, I am no longer watching your channel. And then you get 5 or 10 other people. And before you know it, someone appears on that channel who otherwise would not have appeared. FAIR's history of activism against corporate mainstream media is, have we ever transformed corporate media outlet into a fair one? Well, that's an oxymoron. But have we sometimes got people on the air who reach, because of our efforts, 1 million people or 2 million people that aren't the already convinced? We've done that consistently for 20 years. So you're organizing against big media and letting them know why you're leaving them or you're other mobilizing around them sometimes does open up a little bit of terrain in the big media while you're pushing for independent media to flourish.
I was wondering if you guys can explain what was behind the sudden emergence of this
national intelligence estimate.
So can we be, optimistic that there is some kind of higher authority on international politics or American foreign policy, some kind of consensus above Bush administration to redirect this madness?
Unfortunately, that's what they want you to believe. You know, for years now, the national intelligence community had been pushing an estimate that said that Iran does not have an active nuclear program, doesn't have a nuclear program at all, that there's no evidence for such a nuclear program. The Bush administration would not allow this estimate to be published. Indeed, the Bush administration sent it back with enough caveats that you created this 2005 draft that they tried to get published, but they couldn't get national consensus. But it was a draft that was basically written by the Office of the Vice President that said that Iran has an active ongoing nuclear weapons program. Well, the intelligence community had been rejecting this and rejecting this and rejecting this, and many on Capitol Hill said, when you talk about Iran policy, we need to have a national intelligence estimate upon which this policy is based. So suddenly we have the publication of this estimate. Well, I'll tell you what precluded or what preceded this estimate was a determination by the IAEA through their technical findings that they were going to certify that Iran was not pursuing an active nuclear weapons program. There was no evidence whatsoever to sustain this. Now, the Bush administration had a problem because they had been relying upon the IAEA's information to generate the Board of Governors' opposition to Iran's program to stimulate the Security Council to pass resolutions sanctioning Iran until they suspend their program. And this is what Europe was rallying behind. And now it's going to be undercut because how do you sanction Iran to suspend a program because until we find out that it's not nuclear weapons related now that the IAEA says it's not nuclear weapons related? So suddenly we get this magical estimate that's punched out there that says there is no nuclear weapons program ongoing today. And everybody says, yee-haw, it takes the wind out of the sails. It did no such thing, sir, because it created de facto proof that a weapons program existed. And that was never the consensus prior to this. Now, in saying that there is no ongoing program, we now have consensus that there was a program. And here's the danger. Because the European community has already bought into the notion of sanctioning Iran. I call it the sanctions trap. And we now have three successive Security Council resolutions passed under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter with unanimous support from these European allies of ours saying that Iran must suspend its uranium enrichment program. The NIE hasn't changed that reality one iota, and Iran continues to refuse to suspend, therefore creating the conditions under which we may deem they are doing something deep, dark, and nefarious, such as creating the conditions for the reemergence of this nuclear weapons program everybody now agrees existed in 2003, which never existed in 2003. This NIE has created very, very dangerous conditions. It's not a declaration of independence. It's a key example of how the Office of the Vice President continues to manipulate truth to misinform the American public to achieve an objective, which is regime change based upon American military intervention in an area of the world we have no business intervening in.
And I want to address another wrinkle. We learned that shortly after the NIE on the nuclear question that there's this, quote, provocation in the Strait of Hormuz. I think there's ways that those who are pushing for a war can push for a confrontation with Iran. There's nothing to do with nuclear. That would be perhaps issue two. Or issue three. But they're looking for other provocations, sponsorship of terrorism, helping the insurgents, helping someone in Iraq, or some confrontation in the Strait. But I want to get to the underlying question, which is a very good one, about this group we can call the governing elite. We could call it the establishment. We could call it the ruling class. There's always splits among them. There were splits before the war, the invasion of Iraq. There was a split so severe that some of Papa Bush's people, like Brent Scowcroft, were writing very powerful columns in the Wall Street Journal, not exactly an alternative publication, saying here's the reasons we should not invade Iraq. And that faction lost. And they were just overwhelmed by three, four, five other factions. I think you're right to say there's obviously factions in the establishment that don't want an invasion of Iran. There's no doubt about that. Even a military, an airstrike against Iran. The reality is there's a lot of powerful forces pushing for it. One of the powerful forces is what I call the Israel right or wrong lobby. I'm sure military corporations, people say, how are we going to fund it? It's not sustainable. Where are we going to get the troops? The military industrial corporations are just greed merchants, and war is good for them. And you have AEI, you have these think tanks that are professional war instigators. Their kids never die. Where's Wolfowitz now? He left the World Bank And now he's got his job at American Enterprise Institute, and he's got a volunteer job again. He's the head of some advisory committee to our U.S. State Department. The guy who showed such great judgment on Iraq is now going to help out with proliferation issues. So I think there are splits within the elite, but there's still a lot of – and I know a lot of them are probably scared S-less about an attack on Iran. The reality is – that the leading presidential candidates for the Democrats, after you exclude someone like Kucinich, have all said in regards to Iran, all options are on the table. That's insane. And so there's not a debate. When some progressives in the Democratic Party and some not progressives tried to get attached to the supplemental bill that gave more money to Iraq occupation, but it was going to have some conditions, it had a strict thing in there, clear as black and white, that said no money can be spent on any attack on Iran without prior specific congressional approval. And that was cut out. Pelosi was leaned on by some people close to the Israel Right or Wrong lobby. So there are some people in Washington pushing for invasion. And I think there's some people in the establishment that are afraid of any kind of an attack on Iran.
As if the situation in Iran and Iraq were bad, I'm a little concerned about Turkey's behavior and their motivations. They have clearly said that they do not want a Kurdish state on their border. The Russians aren't too happy about it either, and neither are the Iranians. And these three nations do not want a Kurdish state. Turkey seems to have no problems invading with an invasion of northern Iraq. And I just would ask you to comment on what you think they will do and when.
First of all, I'll just say, find me a country that wants an independent Kurdistan. There is none. There's no country out there today that wants an independent Kurdistan. There's a handful of Kurds that want an independent Kurdistan. But it's not just Iran. Syria doesn't want it. You know, Iraq doesn't want it. Nobody wants it. So that's one of the big problems you have. The other problem is, you know, people have been sucked into this notion that Afghanistan is a justifiable intervention by the American military because we were attacked on 9/11, because Osama bin Laden and the al-Qaeda plotters were given safe haven by the Taliban on Afghan soil. Therefore, if you give safe haven to the terrorists, we're going to come in and we're going to get you. Isn't that what the president said? Of course he did. Now, definition of terrorism set clearly by U.S. code. And U.S. code has been used to define a number of groups as terrorist groups, one of which is the PKK. Now, you may differ with that interpretation, but I'm just telling you, by U.S. law, the PKK is a terrorist group. They operate out of Iraqi soil. What are the Turks up to? Simply doing that which we did to Afghanistan, that if you give safe haven to a group that's going to train and plan and implement attacks on your soil, terrorist attacks, then you better be prepared to pay the price. What are the Turks up to? They're going to eliminate the PKK operated on northern Iraqi soil, plain and simple. Now, it's complicated, you see, because Iraq isn't truly a sovereign nation. It's a nation under occupation by America. And it even gets more complicated because this PKK group that our State Department labels as a terrorist group receives funding by the CIA to abet the PJAK, an Iranian Kurdish group operating on soil in northern Iraq, to undermine the Iranian government in this effort to achieve regime change. So the Turks are now going after a terrorist group that we call a terrorist group, but we support, to commit terror in Iran. It's a very complicated situation. I'm not here to defend Turkish action against the Kurds. You know, I think there's been an oppression there and all that. But to sit there and say that, you know, what are the Turks up to when striking into northern Iraq? It's really a black and white situation. Somebody, a group labeled as terrorist, is using northern Iraqi soil as a base of operations to carry out terrorist acts inside Turkey. And the Turks are exercising their legitimate right of self-defense. And if they expand on this, this is one of the definitions of failure of the Bush administration's Iraq policy. If they expand on this, it will unhinge even more the situation in the Middle East, the situation in Iraq.
I just wanted to let my question go and forego that for the purpose of making one suggestion as an action item. And this goes to the comment that you made and anybody else in this room. I'm from Iran, was born in Iran, moved to U.S. about like right before the revolution. So I have a decent point of view and perspective about both the politics in this country as well as in Iran, and especially the Iranian culture and everything else that is more of a mystery to the people who are doubtful about Iran's and how dangerous Iran can be to them. If you organize a tea session or any session in your kitchens, in your houses, or in your community center, I volunteer to be there. And then I would be the person that who can, like, you know, have a debate or share a perspective or at least put a face to an Iranian rather than just like, you know, just an unknown mystery. If you do it, I will stand in that corner by that huge television. I'll give you my name, my email address, my telephone, and I am certain that I can also get other Iranians to join me and provide that debate. And if you just want to bring four people, five people, it's up to you. But if you're ready, I'll show up and I'll be there. Thank you.
Thank you.
How many people realize that next month President Bush is going to give himself permission to invade anything he wants to?
Pretty much.
I mean, because next month he actually signs an agreement with the present government of Iraq saying that we will defend that government against internal or external attack. Right? So next month he is binding us as a country to his principle of being able to defend that country, whether it's from its own people or whether it's from an external source, which includes Iran. All right? That happens next month. All right? So every time somebody says, we can't do anything, I don't care. Do something. Write a letter to your congressman. I don't care if it's futile. Write it anyway. Okay. Write it to the paper, okay, to whoever. Talk, okay, to your friends. Do something. Don't just sit there and say, we can't anymore.
Have you read Crossing the Rubicon by Michael Rupert? Okay. Basically, it goes down to, like, this whole war is about natural resources, oil, and the neocon agenda, you know, to we have no other power in the world, so we're going to go all around the world and have hegemonic control of all the natural resources in the world. And to do this, they needed something like 9/11. I'm not saying that it was planned or, you know, made up. But, but the whole thing is, if we keep doing this, we are, and we're headed in that direction now, we're not going to be no constitutional republic anymore. We will be an empire, but we, which in some ways we already are, but we will be an empire in decline. Thank you.
Yes, the presidential candidates, Hillary, for instance, don't you think that much of her warmongering is just posturing to stand up to appear tough? And perhaps if she became president, which is likely, she would be a little bit more reasonable with that. And John McCain, surely he knows the horrors of war and perhaps knows how misguided Vietnam was. Why do you think he's so pro-war?
Okay, keep going. Two more quick ones.
Okay, I have a good one. When David Frost had his interview with Benazir Bhutto, and she mentioned about the murder of Osama bin Laden, I'd like to hear your comments about that.
There's many ways to respond to these madmen. One way is to show up every Sunday at 5 o'clock. There's an ongoing protest against this occupation, started October 6th of 02. We knew 5 months in advance that this was horseshit. So come on out at 5 o'clock every single Sunday.
Where?
15th and High, right in front of OSU.
Okay, I'm going to leave the Benazir Bhutto comment about bin Laden, but I do want to comment on Hillary Clinton and McCain. These are two individuals I study. Scott will do your question. I don't believe in any way that Hillary Clinton is talking tough to get elected, but somehow she's got a different agenda. I believe, from having studied her for many, many years, that she believes in pretty much a unitary executive. So did her. Her husband was very much. I think it's not a mistake that she was on the board of Walmart. She's got a very strong corporate orientation. I think on foreign policy, she's got an Israel right or wrong orientation that puts Bush to shame. On Cuba, she's announced no change at all in policy. I don't think it's a game with her. It wasn't with her husband. Her husband had 8 years to end Star Wars National Defense and didn't. And so I think she's saying exactly what she believes, and I think it's a scary situation. I long for the day when, you know, our country's in decline, that one day we'll start going up again. But what I see is when the extremist Republicans are in power, we go like this, and then the Clintons take over, and we still decline, but at a lesser rate. That's not good enough for me. As for McCain, I think he learned all the wrong lessons from Vietnam. I think here's a guy who, I empathize with the awful suffering he had to endure for years in custody. But the lesson he drew from Vietnam pushed him right into sending young kids into an even more reckless war in Iraq. And I think he's crazed about Iran. I just don't think he's very steady either. That's my short comments. Well, obviously, I would prefer President Kucinich, but he's dropped out of the race. And of the front runners, and this is, I'm speaking only for myself, of the so-called first tier, although they hardly mention the third guy because the corporate media covers it as a Hillary Obama celebrity grudge match, I think that of the three, Hillary Clinton is clearly the worst. Obama is would be better in a number of regards than her, and John Edwards is way better than both of them. And
you know, what's amazing about the David Frost interview that was referenced is, how few Americans know that this interview actually took place. And some amazing things were said in it. But I'm going to put on my intelligence officer's hat for a second. I used to make a living assessing the reliability of sources. And unlike the CIA managers who gave us curveball and Chalabi, I actually have a pretty good track record of selecting sources who are reliable. And there is a process that goes into it, one of which is to determine whether or not that source could reasonably have access to the information that they claim to possess. Benazir Bhutto, with all due respect, was in exile in England. She wasn't plugged into any intelligence service. She was plugged into the Bhutto family, Sindhalese Pakistanis, who were in an opposition party, the PPP. Come on, guys, let's treat them with respect. We don't make fun of, they can make fun of us. We don't make fun of their political party names. My kids do chuckle. But the point is, where's her source? I mean, I've got friends and colleagues who are in what we call Tier 1 commando units. And their job is to go around the world hunting Osama bin Laden. And they take it very seriously. And the United States government puts a tremendous amount of resources, contrary to popular belief, into the hunt for Osama bin Laden. We don't pull the trigger every time we have a chance. But we are actively trying to find where this guy is. So are the Pakistanis. And so are a number of other organizations who have a lot more credibility when it comes to being able to gather information and access data than the PPP party of Pakistan and the British-based exile Benazir Bhutto. Politicians will say just about anything to get attention. And I think Benazir Bhutto was in the process of trying to position herself favorably with the Pakistani people as an alternative to Musharraf. One of the things that she had been talking about is Musharraf's links with extremists and fundamentalists. And I just think she was trying to get herself into the headlines. I don't think Benazir Bhutto has a clue what happened. Well, she's dead now, but had a clue what happened to Osama bin Laden. She was just not in a position to know. And if somebody comes and whispers in her ear, I guarantee they would have whispered in 20 other ears before it got to her. I think it was a rumor. I think she repeated the rumor. And I think Frost's interview gave credence to a rumor. But at the end of the day, it was just a rumor.
My name is Patty Schaefer. I'm the director of the Ohio Election Justice Campaign, and I have looked extensively for years into what happened with the Ohio election. And I think if everyone in this room stepped forward to the Secretary of State and the Attorney General and demanded an actual investigation and prosecution, we can take this whole regime down now. The evidence is here. Jennifer Brunner sits on over 2,200 boxes of the actual ballots, the records from the election, the stolen election. It's right here. It's sitting here in Columbus, and it just needs dealt with. And if every one of you stepped up and did that, we could resolve this before March. And I invite all of you to show up with me to the Attorney General's office and the Secretary of State. I've got a website up at electiondefensealliance.com/OEJC, which stands for Ohio Election Justice Campaign, and join me. We can resolve this here in Ohio where we were robbed.
Hi, I'm from Code Pink Columbus, and I'm and I'm curious what you know about. There's been a lot of chatter going on about a domestic terrorism bill that a lot of people in Code Pink think would enable the government to sort of do a minority report if they wanted to on anybody who they think maybe was thinking about suggesting violence, and that even Code Pink could end up being, you know. What do you know about that, and what do you think about that?
I'm going to take one more quick one.
We're both on the board of the Green Education Fund, so we help sponsor this event. So I'm going to take the initiative, say we're both going to ask a question.
I'm going to make it real quick. I agree with everything Mr. Ritter said, except I'm not real sure that the Constitution is actually something that, frankly, is going to be the force that we should use for the underlying force, because, I mean, the ladies talked about elections. I did a good job here about the elections. According to the Constitution, it takes two-thirds of both houses of Congress and three-quarters of the states in order to amend the Constitution. So it's almost to blame the American people to a certain extent, yes, but I think it's almost impossible to really do anything on a national level. So my question is, do you think that United States Declaration of Human Rights might be a better vehicle for to base our attitudes on as far as progressive change and to keep us from becoming even more of an imperialist power and so forth? Thank you.
Mine is, what will it take, or when will we like dig deeper than the Constitution in American roots and find the roots of the tree of peace planted in the 15th century by Degaudawida, the peacemaker? And when do we stop thinking like Americans and think like members of the whole human race?
The ultimate challenge, how do 300 million people stop believing they have a right to dictate to 6.8 billion people the terms of coexistence? Again, X equals Y plus Z. All right, the X factor. Only we can solve that. Okay, in order to solve the X factor, we got to know who we are and what we are. And with all due respect to the statement of universal peace, I'm familiar with, but I don't embrace it. It's irrelevant. Because the only thing that matters in this country is the rule of law set forth by that framework, which is recognized by everybody. That's called the Constitution. And yeah, you know, it ain't pretty. It took a long time to give African Americans less than two-thirds status, any status at all. It took even longer to give women the right to vote. It's taken a long time, and we're still struggling on civil rights. Okay, it's not a perfect document. It's a document that can be changed through a process which is spelled out by the document. But it is a document founded on the notion of history. And what I mean by that is that good things don't happen overnight. In fact, is one of the things the Founding Fathers wanted to ensure is that we don't have some sort of mass movement where we go shifting this way, that way, and this way, and that way. The Constitution provides that speed break of sanity through due process, which is frustrating and long. But you know what? If you recognize the Constitution and you engage in the process, you will get the change. But if you sit there and say, that takes too long, then what you're saying is, I'm more important than the Constitution. And if you're more important than the Constitution, you're more important than America, and you have no place in America. And that's how I personally feel on this issue. Respect the Constitution, live the Constitution, breathe the Constitution, and let the Constitution work for you. But if you reject the Constitution and walk away from the Constitution, all you get is chaos. And that's what we have right now, is chaos. And now on your question. One of the reasons why Code Pink needs to fear, and I tell you, you better start fearing, and all Americans better start fearing, is because we have walked away from the Constitution. The Constitution gives you inalienable rights. You have the right to freedom of speech, the right to assembly, and all these other rights that are spelled out. And what's happening now by under the Bush administration with the absolute compliance of a democratically controlled Congress is that in the name of security generated by fear based upon our ignorance, we are going to sell these rights down the stream. And what we're saying is that in order to maintain security, the government has to be allowed to do certain things to certain people under certain conditions. Now, most Americans, if you're white like me, will sit there and go, well, I got nothing to fear. I've done nothing wrong. It's not my problem. They're going after, you know, there's nothing wrong with racial. I mean, those damn Muslims bombed us, brown people. And if you're Mexican and you look like you're an Arab, too bad. You got brown eyes and black hair and you look a little greasy and I don't trust you. So I'm gonna allow the government in the interest of my security to infringe on your rights. And it's a trap we've all, not all of us in this room, but it's a trap America's fallen into. The false promise of security is compelling us to give up the liberties that make us different from everybody else. If you allow this government to infringe on the civil liberties of a single American, regardless of ethnicity, religion, or gender, they've infringed on the civil liberties of every single American. We are all at risk. This is a very, very dangerous time. They will sell it to you saying you have nothing to worry about if you've done nothing wrong. The problem is, what is the definition of wrong? Peaceful assembly? But when it becomes inconvenient to the powers that be because they say that maybe your movement has been infiltrated by those who want to do harm, this government is replete with a history of abuses of power. And the only thing that checks the power is the Constitution being implemented by a legislative branch that checks unitary executive authority. And that's not happening. The Constitution is the solution. Believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen, read the Constitution. I can only implore that so many times. It may sound a little moot, but all the problems of America today are derived from the fact that we have deviated off course from the fundamental values and ideals set forth by that document.
I was, as a leftist, I was somewhat of a Constitution doubter until I went to law school in the 70s. And of course, traveling around with Scott Ritter, you start looking at that Constitution, looking at it again, and it is an amazing document. The Constitution plus those first 10 amendments and the way it's a working, breathing document that has Martin Luther King Jr. swore by it. He was trying to breathe life into it. So it is an amazing document. Of course, to amend it is slow. But you put it together with the first 10 amendments. It was an amazing step forward for history, even though it was a racist document. It was an anti-women. But it led to all these possibilities of reform. And one of the beautiful things about the Constitution is that it talks about the highest laws of the land include our international treaties. And we have signed a number of important treaties that are all very good treaties, including the United Nations Charter. So I don't see a contradiction between the Constitution on one hand and the UN Charter on the other. It would be a great thing if we had a country that lived up to its Constitution and we lived up to these treaties that we have signed. And I think that's a good way for us to end, is it's up to us to breathe life into those documents, including the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Thank you.